how slowly the mafioso was opening the door. Had he sensed Harvath as well? His question was answered as soon as he saw the muzzle of the man's pistol. Sliding his foot forward so that Ragusa couldn't slam the door into his face, Harvath grabbed the barrel of the weapon and yelled, "Gun!" as he wrenched the weapon sideways out of his grasp. Barton leapt from where he had been hiding, grabbed Ragusa by his jacket, and wrestled him into the apartment. The two men landed in a tangled pile on the floor. Though he was taller and much heavier, the mafioso was no match for the younger and stronger SEAL. A fan of mixed martial arts, Barton liked nothing more than going to the ground. In no time flat, he had Ragusa in a submission hold, and, demoralized, the man gave up. Getting him to his feet, they marched him into the kitchen, where they duct-taped him to a chair. Harvath had already unloaded the man's Beretta pistol and had placed it on top of the refrigerator. Emptying his pockets, he placed his keys, wallet, cash, and cell phone on the counter. Pulling up a chair, he swung a leg over and sat on it backward. He rested his arms on the back of the chair as he studied Ragusa. Anger simmered all over the Sicilian's face. As soon as Harvath asked him if he spoke English, the mafioso began cursing at him in Italian. Spittle collected in the corners of his mouth. He went on and on, no doubt unpacking everything he was going to do to his captors once this was all over. Harvath let him get it out of his system. Then, giving him one last chance to admit whether he spoke English, he called in Lovett. Chapter 60. Even though Harvath was addressing Lovett, he looked directly at Ragusa as he spoke.
"Who is this?"
he asked, holding up his phone with a picture of Mustafa Marzouk, the deceased chemistry student.
"He says he doesn't know," she replied.
"Tell him to look harder."
"Same answer. He claims he doesn't recognize the man."
"Ask him about Festus Agaku, the water taxi driver for the Black Axe."
Lovett did and waited for his reply. It came back the same. Ragusa claimed he had no idea who they were talking about. Harvath was losing his patience. Holding the picture back up, he said,
"6 weeks ago, you sent Festus Agaku and his crew out into a storm to meet a boat from Libya. On it was the man in the picture. Who is he, and who told you to pick him up?"
He burned holes into the man's eyes with his own as Lovett spoke. When the man responded, Harvath didn't need a translation. It was the same answer he had been giving since the beginning.
"Tell him I know everything about him. I know about his wife. I know about his 5 children. I know where he lives. And tell him that I know all about the men and the dogs he uses to protect his house and his family, none of which will stop me from getting to them."
As Lovett translated, Harvath watched as the anger and rage returned to the man's face. She hadn't even finished speaking before he went off on another tirade of curses and threats. When Lovett began to translate, Harvath shook his head. He had gotten the gist of it.
"Let me be perfectly clear," Harvath stated, once the man had finished. "You will tell me everything I want to know. The only question is how much pain you want to experience in the process."
This time, when the man started cursing at him, Harvath didn't let it go. Cupping his hand, he hit Ragusa on the left side of his head. It was the same technique he had used on the satellite phone salesman in Libya. It forced a painful stream of pressurized air into the ear canal, which could cause dizziness and even nausea. Harvath had learned it as a SEAL, and he liked it for 2 reasons. One, it didn't risk breaking any bones in the hand the way a punch could, and 2, it didn't leave any marks, unless you struck the subject so hard that you ruptured the eardrum. Out of respect for Lovett, he was trying to be as measured as possible. He waited for the man to shake the stars from his head before continuing. Once he felt the mafioso had recovered enough, he spoke very slowly and explained,
"I know honor is important to you as a Sicilian. So if you do not cooperate with me, I'm going to make sure that your body is found right here with your Nigerian girlfriend. But that's not all. I'm going to make it look like both of you overdosed on drugs, and I will stage a scene that leaves no doubt that in your relationship, Naya was the man, and you, Carlo Ragusa, were the woman. Understand?
He understood all right. When Lovett finished translating, the mobster exploded. It was his angriest reaction yet. Harvath had found his button.
I will make sure that your wife and children know exactly how and where your body was discovered, and I'll make sure all of your enemies know. And when word spreads, I'll make sure that there are plenty of pictures, which will live forever on the internet. In fact, when people in Sicily hear the name Ragusa, I promise you, that's the only thing they'll think of.
Yet again, the Sicilian went ballistic. But when Harvath raised his hand to slap him, he stopped. For a second, he wondered if they were making progress. Holding his phone back up and showing the mobster the photo of Mustafa Marzouk, he asked,
"Where was he going? Where were you supposed to take him?"
Shaking his head, Ragusa smiled and repeated his same stale line in Italian.
"I don't know what you're talking about."
Harvath smiled back.
"Do you like being in the smuggling business, Carlo? Do you like smuggling terrorists and being responsible for helping to drown countless people?"
Lovett listened to him and then said to Harvath,
"He says he's not a smuggler. He owns a few nightclubs, but his real business is in growing lemons and tangerines."
Harvath looked at her and replied,
"Tell him we're done talking."
He then nodded at Barton, who stepped into the kitchen from behind, and pulled a pillowcase over the mafioso's head. Tying it tight at the base of his skull, he tipped the man's chair back onto its rear legs and dragged him into the bathroom. There, he set him down with his back to the half-filled tub. When Harvath nodded, Barton tipped the chair backward so that it rested against the edge of the tub, and Ragusa's head was suspended over the water. Anticipating what was about to happen, the mobster began to struggle. Barton held the chair firm.
"Drowning is a terrible way to die," said Harvath.
From the doorway, Lovett translated. Now, Harvath was really done talking, and he signaled for Lovett that she could go. She shook her head. No, she intended to stay. That was fine by him. Grabbing the plastic pitcher sitting on the side of the tub, Harvath filled it with water, and without any warning, began to slowly pour it over Ragusa's nose and mouth. Chapter 61. The mobster sputtered and coughed as he thrashed back and forth in his chair, trying to escape the water, but there was no escape. Harvath kept slowly pouring. It took 40 seconds, but it must have felt like a lifetime to Ragusa. When the pitcher was empty, Harvath refilled it. He paused to let the mafioso just begin to catch his breath, and then, as soon as he began to inhale, began the process all over again. It had been his experience that if he stopped right after the first round, subjects tried to hold out longer. But immediately going into a second round scrambled their brains. They became panicked. So Harvath poured from the pitcher once more. Halfway through, Ragusa began to vomit. Harvath untied the pillowcase and had Barton lean the chair forward, back onto all four legs. He let him get it all out of his system, and then nodded for Barton to lean him back against the tub. Right away, the mobster began to protest. Harvath refilled the pitcher and started again from full. Ragusa thrashed even more violently this time. Harvath decided to stretch his pour a few extra seconds. By the time he was done, the mobster had been broken. Harvath motioned Lovett all the way into the bathroom so that she could hear what Ragusa was saying. The CIA operative tried to step around the mess. The floor was disgusting, and the smell was growing unbearable. She had Ragusa repeat what he had been mumbling and then translated for Harvath.
"He says he knows the man in your picture."
"What's his name?"
Harvath replied. Lovett presented the question to him in Italian and then said,
"He doesn't remember the name, something Muslim, but he does remember the man's face.
Tell him he's going to have to do a hell of a lot better than that."
She did, and then waited while Ragusa spoke. Finally, she replied,
"He was important, a VIP."
VIP to whom?
He doesn't know. Harvath looked at her.
What does he mean, he doesn't know? Who paid him?
Levitt repeated the question to the mafioso and waited for him to answer. As he spoke, she translated.
This wasn't a usual job. He did it as a favor.
For whom?
He says he can't reveal the name. If he does, it will start a war.
Harvath rolled his eyes and, looking at Barton, said,
He obviously wants more. Tip him back over.
No, no, no,
the man implored. The word was the same in English as it was in Italian. While he screamed, Harvath filled a new pitcher of water. Just as he began to pour, the man yelled out another detail.
Roma!
Who the hell's Roma?
Harvath asked. But Levitt held up her hand for him to be quiet. After a quick back and forth with Ragusa, she said,
It's not a person. It's the city, Rome. That's where they were taking the chemist.
What were they supposed to do once they got him there?
The CIA operative asked the mobster and then replied,
Apparently, he had his own people there who would get him the rest of the way into Europe.
Bullshit, said Harvath,
as he began pouring the water over Ragusa's face. Again, the man cried out, pleading with him to stop. Harvath didn't until his pitcher was empty. Then he filled it back up.
Per favore, no,
he begged.
Tell him I want to know who he did the favor for. Who asked him to smuggle Mustafa to Rome?
Marzouk,
the Sicilian interjected, screaming the man's name.
Mustafa Marzouk!
If he was hoping that was going to get him off the hook, he was sorely mistaken. Levitt explained as much to him. They went back and forth until Harvath once more lost his patience. Filling the pitcher, he told Levitt to stand back. Ragusa began to beg.
Give me a name.
No, per favore, basta,
he insisted. Harvath let the water flow.
La formicula,
the mobster cried as he choked.
La formicula, per favore, basta.
Harvath stopped and looked at Lovett, who began questioning Ragusa. Soon enough, he gave up a name.
Antonio Votari, she said, also known as La Formicula, or the Ant.
Who is he?
Mafia from Calabria. They're called the 'Ndrangheta.
Harvath knew Calabria. If Italy was a boot, it was the part that made up the toe and looked like it was kicking the island of Sicily. He was about to ask her another question when his phone vibrated. Pulling it from his pocket, he read the message. It was a text from Stalin.
What is it?
Levitt asked.
I don't know, he replied, signaling Barton to keep an eye on Ragusa. A whole bunch of cars just pulled up outside.
Walking to the front of the darkened apartment, Harvath moved the curtain only a matter of millimeters so he could look. Down on the street, he saw a string of three black sedans, a black SUV, and a black windowless van. As he watched, someone opened the front passenger door of the lead vehicle and stepped out. Were these Ragusa's people? The man standing in the street took out a cell phone, pressed a button, and raised it to his ear. Seconds later, Harvath heard a ring coming from the kitchen where they had left the mobster's cell phone. Instantly, Harvath's mind began to turn, figuring out how they were going to get the hell out of there without getting in a gunfight. But then he heard Levitt answer the call, in English. Turning around, he saw her holding her own cell phone.
It's the Carabinieri, she stated. They say they have men on the roof, and the building is surrounded.
Chapter 62. CIA Headquarters, Langley, Virginia. In the aftermath of the Paris attack, it had been all hands on deck. People had been in and out of the Central Intelligence Agency all afternoon. Director McGee hadn't been able to reach out to Lydia Ryan until after 5 o'clock. He had asked his assistant to summon her back and tell her to come ready to travel. When she arrived in the director's conference room, McGee was waiting for her. Any problems? He asked.
None,
she replied, as she set her rolling suitcase upright and unzipped it. I appreciate you sending your team down to meet me at the car.
Extending her hand, she helped Nicholas climb out.
He thanked her and then turned and shook hands with the director.
I apologize for the subterfuge, said McGee.
That's the business you're in, Nicholas responded. Besides, how many people can say they were smuggled into the CIA in a piece of luggage?
McGee smiled. Hopefully, you're the only one.
As we agreed, Ryan reminded him, this isn't a story you're ever going to tell.
Agreed, the little man conceded. That is our arrangement.
Getting down to business, the director asked, how much time do you think you're going to need?
It depends on how the Malice source code is structured. I only need a piece of it, but we'll have to test it and make sure it works.
Is Jake good with all of this? Ryan asked.
McGee nodded. Jake Fleischer was a brilliant hacker and IT specialist. In the CIA's Directorate of Digital Innovation, his expertise in cyber threats and cybersecurity were second to none. Fleischer could have been running the agency's Center for Cyber Intelligence. He was eminently qualified, but he didn't want the headache. Fleischer wanted to be on the cutting edge, pushing the boundaries of what the CIA could do when it came to cyber espionage.
Jake's on board, said the director.
How much did you have to tell him?
I told him this was important, that he needed to trust me, and that he'd be the only person in this room with a computer.
Nicholas looked from Ryan to McGee.
I don't understand. How am I supposed to get what I need?
You're going to work with Jake, the director replied. Every string of code you need, he's going to get it for you.
It would be a lot faster if...
McGee cut him off.
It's not personal, Nicholas. It's business. I'm not giving you unfettered, unsupervised access to the agency's cyber arsenal. This happens my way, or it doesn't happen at all.
The little man nodded. He understood. While the Carlton Group was building an ARC to save America's intelligence capabilities, McGee had taken an oath to faithfully serve his country and execute his duties as the director of the CIA.
How confident are we that what happens in this room will stay in this room? Asked Ryan. Even as deputy DCI, I don't have any history with Fleischer.
A large part of what I've been doing, McGee replied, is identifying core personnel who are mission critical as we move forward. People who believe in the agency's mission and are absolutely dedicated to it. Jake's one of them. He knows that something very serious is going on, but that the details of what he's being asked to do cannot be fully explained. He also understands he isn't allowed to talk to anyone about this.
Ryan smiled.
Real cloak and dagger. That's what everybody here signs up for, right? And on top of that, it's an assignment from the director himself. What else could he have said but yes?
He's a good man, McGee added, as he turned and looked at Nicholas. He also understands that there are some unorthodox components associated with this.
Meaning me,
the little man stated.
The director nodded as the phone in front of him rang.
Picking it up, he listened to his assistant and said,
Okay, thank you.
Turning to Ryan and Nicholas, he said, Jake's here.
Chapter 63 Palermo, Sicily.
You lied to me, Paolo, Lovett stated.
They were in a safe house in Albergheria, the oldest of the four mandamenti, or historical districts that made up the old city of Palermo. Paolo Argento stood in front of a table where his men had arrayed the weapons taken from the Americans.
You lied to me as well.
Argento was a handsome, fit man in his early 50s. He was tan, with spiked gray hair and a neatly trimmed gray beard. He wore black jeans, black boots, and an untucked black button-down shirt. His sleeves were rolled up to his elbows. On his left wrist was a black Panerai diver's watch. The Carabinieri operated under the Italian Ministry of Defense, and the ROS was the Carabinieri's main investigative unit.
The number one goal of the ROS was taking down organized crime and terrorist networks. They conducted a tremendous amount of undercover work, as well as high-risk assault operations. They reported directly to the Carabinieri General Command. Of all the elite special units in Italy, theirs was given the most operational freedom. As a highly successful and highly respected commander, Argento was able to call most of his own shots, and this was one of those times.
"You should have told me you had the bartender's apartment wired," Lovett insisted.
Argento smiled.
"If I had, you would have chosen someplace else to snatch Ragusa. This was the safest way. It was a contained environment. He didn't have his bodyguards. No one got hurt."
They were standing in the safe house's large living room. Peeling frescoes, hundreds of years old, covered the walls. Standing near one of the windows, Harvath asked,
"So now what?"
Morrison, Barton, and Stalin were one floor below, being watched over by Argento's men. They weren't officially under arrest, but no one was free to leave. Ragusa, Naya, and Ragusa's two bodyguards had been placed in restraints and were being held in a different part of the building. Under Italian law, Argento could hold them for 72 hours without charging them. Harvath had a feeling he could probably hold them a lot longer than that if he wanted to. Ragusa might not like it, but he knew the ROS had the upper hand, and there was nothing he could do about it. Argento turned his attention to Harvath. He had a slow, confident voice and spoke excellent English.
"What would you do," he asked, "if an Italian intelligence officer, along with four paramilitary operatives, entered the United States, held two people hostage, and tortured one of them?"
"If they'd come to interrogate an organized crime figure connected to terrorism, I'd probably hand them each a medal and ask what else I could do for them," Harvath replied.
"Your bosses might not like that."
"My bosses might not ever need to know."
"Ecco," the Italian said with a grin.
"Fair enough."
"I want you to understand," Harvath explained, pointing to Lovett, "that she was acting on my instructions."
"So, you are in charge, then?"
Harvath nodded.
"None of you are carrying passports, credit cards, or any sort of identification. I assume you left everything at Sionella."
Neither Harvath nor Lovett responded.
"Don't look so surprised," Argento said, as he winked at Lovett. "I ran a trace on your cell phone. I know what towers it was pinging off of."
"Piove sul bagnato,"
Lovett replied. "When it rains, it pours." Argento's grin spread into a smile.
"When the cat goes to steal the lard, it always leaves a footprint," he said in Italian.
Harvath didn't speak Italian and had no idea what they were talking about. Argento noticed the look on his face.
"The best laid plans of mice and men often go awry. No?"
Harvath nodded.
"If it can go wrong, it often does."
The Italian shifted gears and walked toward him.
"You don't remember me, do you?"
It was so abrupt that Harvath's defenses immediately shot up. His mind went into overdrive, trying to place how the two knew each other.
"Relax," the Italian said,
aware that he had put him on guard. Raising his hands, he framed his eyes, blocking out the rest of his face.
"It was a decade ago, but you were with another beautiful blonde American. My team and I picked you up in..."
"A helicopter,"
Harvath replied, as it all came back to him.
"A fast one, an Augusta."
The woman Argento was referring to was Meg Cassidy, a hijacking survivor he had teamed up with to track down a terrorist hell-bent on igniting a war in the Middle East. The target had been a peace summit hosted by Italy. With the help of the Italians, Harvath had prevented an attack on one of the delegations, designed to look as if the Israelis had been behind it.
"You were part of the Rapid Reaction Force," said Harvath.
Argento nodded.
"I was the team leader.
We picked you up in Rome and flew with you out to Frascati. With my helmet and balaclava,
I don't blame you for not recognizing me.
Harvath smiled. Lovett looked at them both.
Wait, you two know each other?
Argento nodded.
Unfortunately, bad actors have brought us back together.
Speaking of which, what can you tell us about Antonio Votari?
Harvath asked. The Italian held up his hand.
First, you're going to tell me everything you know about Mustafa Marzouk. Then, we'll have a discussion about La Formicula.
Chapter 64. Harvath's team was given a place to sleep. One of Argento's men made coffee. It was after midnight when they got down to business. Harvath shared everything he knew. There was no sense in holding back. The Italians were aware that American intelligence had been looking for Mustafa Marzouk. They were also aware of chatter about impending terror attacks in Europe. What they didn't know was how the two were connected. From how the laptop of doom had been discovered and what it contained, to everything that had gone down at Burning Man and in Libya, he walked Argento through all of it. The Italian listened intently, interrupting only occasionally to ask a question or probe for more information. When Harvath had finished, he set his coffee cup down on the table and leaned back on the couch. Argento had his laptop out. On it was the audio they had recorded from the bartender's apartment. He listened to it several times, smoking a cigarette and making notes as he did. There were several things he wanted Ragusa to clarify, and he ran his list of questions by Harvath. As any good investigator would, he wanted all the details, no matter how small. How was the mobster planning to get Marzouk to Rome? Where was the drop-off? Was he supposed to provide him with new identification documents? Was he supposed to provide a phone or a new SIM card? Money? Clothing? The list went on. Once he had written down everything he could think of, he handed the questions to one of his ROS operatives and sent him to interrogate Ragusa. Then he turned the conversation to La Formicola, Antonio Votari, and the Calabrian mafia known as the 'Ndrangheta. Having seen the barbarity of organized crime up close, Argento despised it every bit as much as Harvath did. He made no secret of his contempt. But like any wise, experienced warrior, he also respected his enemy, especially what they were capable of. Like the Cosa Nostra of Sicily and the Camorra of Campania, the 'Ndrangheta of Calabria were ruthless. So thoroughly capable was the mafia of getting to anyone who stood in its way that carabinieri were required to work outside their home region for 8 years before they could be trusted to apply for a transfer to come back. It was said that 70% of the carabinieri came from the four Italian regions most plagued by organized crime. Faced with a choice between good and evil, they chose good. They chose to side with law and justice. They were noble men and women engaged in a tough, dangerous fight. And nobody knew that better than Paolo Argento.
Okay, he said, opening a folder on his laptop and bringing up a photo. Let's talk about Antonio Votari.
Harvath and Lovett moved closer to each other so they could see.
Antonio is the nephew of Franco Votari. The Votaris are one of the most powerful families in the Calabrian Mafia. The 'Ndrangheta is considered one of the richest and most powerful organized crime groups in the world. They are known for their extreme violence. Of all its families, the Votaris are considered one of the most brutal. Antonio, like his uncle Franco, is known for his savagery. He's small. That's how he received his nickname.
La Formicula, said Harvath. The ant.
Exactly, replied Argento, as he clicked through pictures of Antonio, as well as bloody crime scene photos. But make no mistake, he's extremely dangerous, deadly even. The 'Ndrangheta have their hands in everything. They traffic in drugs, weapons, prostitution, fraud, extortion, political corruption, contract killing, even black market artifacts looted out of North Africa and the Middle East. If there's money to be made in something illegal, you'll find them there.
Harvath was trying to connect all the dots.
So, ISIS pays Umar Ali Halim to smuggle Marzouk from Libya to Italy. Members of the Black Axe, under Ragusa's control, are sent out to meet him near the island of Lampedusa and bring him to shore. Once Marzouk's feet are dry, Ragusa is supposed to smuggle him to Rome, where he has people who will get him to his final destination. All of which Ragusa is doing as a favor for Antonio Vattari. Why?
Good question, Argento answered. The different mafia networks have been known to work together, but there's always something in it for them. Ragusa wasn't helping La Formicula out of the kindness of his heart. There had to be some sort of transaction.
And what's the Vattari-ISIS connection?
Lovett asked.
Also a good question, and probably even easier to answer. Obviously, ISIS didn't have a smuggling relationship in Italy. They did, apparently, have a relationship with Vattari, and asked him to arrange a smuggler to get Marzouk into Italy, and up to Rome. Was this a relationship based on looted artifacts? Drugs, weapons, all of those are possible. ISIS has been making strong inroads with different mafia groups in southern Italy.
If you had to guess, asked Harvath, which would you pick?
Argento shrugged.
Drugs or stolen artifacts make the most sense.
That's all ISIS really has to offer, unless they're buying weapons,
which could be paid for with artifacts, drugs, or cash.
Correct.
They could also have been buying explosives. The attacks in Spain and Paris might end up leading right back to Vattari.
Or they could have come from another source entirely, the Italian responded. In this case, Vattari may be nothing more than a middleman. ISIS needed a smuggler, and he made the introduction to Ragusa.
Harvath was growing frustrated. There had to be something. Something he was missing.
What if Vattari was lying to Ragusa?
He asked.
About what?
About Mustafa Marzouk having his own people in Rome. People who would get him to his final destination, said Harvath.
Why would he lie about that?
I can think of two reasons. The one that makes the most sense is for operational security purposes. The less Ragusa knew about Marzouk's final destination, the better.
Argento nodded. Agreed. What's the second reason? Harvath was a lot less sure of number two, but he shared it anyway.
What if Rome was Marzouk's final destination? What if that's where the attack was supposed to take place?
Lovett felt a chill run down her spine, as a terrible thought took hold of her mind.
Oh my God, she uttered.
Both men turned to look at her.
What is it?
Asked Harvath.
What if the attack is still on? What if ISIS has already found a replacement chemist?
Before anyone could say another word, Argento pulled out his phone and dialed a highly classified number. Chapter 65. Paris. The best time to make a getaway was in the midst of chaos, when authorities didn't know who or what they were looking for. In the wake of the Tuileries bombings, Paris was in a panic. Emergency vehicles fought to get to and from the scene. The streets were in gridlock. People were terrified about a second round of attacks. No one felt safe. Joining the wave of guests fleeing the city, Tursunov dropped his room key at the front desk of Le Maurice and exited the hotel. Out on the street, he had no need to pause. He had taken in the full spectacle from the balcony of his room. Whatever had caused the first bomber to detonate early was not worth worrying about. As far as he was concerned, the attack had been a success. Cutting across the Pont de la Concorde, he walked to the Boulevard Saint-Germain and took a left. Emergency vehicles continued to speed past, their klaxons blaring and lights flashing. Pulling his rolling suitcase behind him, he was careful to take detours in order to make sure he wasn't being followed. Though this was extremely unlikely, it was good tradecraft.
At the Pont de Sully, in the shadow of the Arab World Institute building, he turned onto the Quai Saint-Bernard. The walk from Le Maurice to the Gare d'Austerlitz took a little over a half hour. The station took its name from a town in the Czech Republic, where Napoleon had defeated a far superior force. There might have been some irony for him there if Paris wasn't full of such monuments. Checking his watch, he saw he had time to stop nearby for a coffee. The train wasn't leaving until 9:22. The less time he spent inside the station, the better. It would only be filled with nervous police and anxious soldiers, suspicious of everything and everyone. He kept walking until he found a cafe with an open terrace where he could also enjoy a cigarette. Taking a seat, he pulled out his Gauloise and called the waiter over. He ordered un sirop, lit his cigarette, then watched the faces of the people who passed by. Their expressions were the same as he had seen up and down the Boulevard Saint-Germain. Shock, sadness, terror. It was all Tursunov could do not to smile. The French, always so quick to participate in bombing runs of Muslim lands, had been served a stern rebuke. From his table, he could also see the TVs on inside. It reminded him of how he sat just days ago in the tiny cafe in Reggio di Calabria, watching the aftermath of the bombing in America. All of the televisions were broadcasting video from the Tuileries. The dead and injured were there in full, high-definition glory for the world to see. The attack had been more than successful. It had been spectacular. The message from ISIS had been delivered, loud and clear. You may advance upon us in Iraq, Libya, or Syria, but you will never, ever defeat us. When his coffee came, he savored it. It was made sweet by the pained face of every passerby. ISIS had indeed won a massive victory, but it was nothing compared to what was in store. Paying his bill, Tursunov struck out in search of a small grocery. He wanted to pick up some edibles for his overnight train ride. When conducting operations, there was rarely anything the Tajik ever looked forward to. Traveling overnight to Nice was an exception. While recuperating from plastic surgery in Pakistan, he had had very little to do. There was only local television and a small shelf with a handful of books. One of those books was about overnight train travel by a British author named Andrew Martin. Over the course of his life, Tursunov had taken many trains. He had even slept on some of them, but only by sitting upright in an uncomfortable seat. He had never known the luxury of a proper sleeping compartment. The book by Martin had opened his eyes to what he had been missing. So while planning the operation, he had decided to make his escape from Paris via the overnight train to Nice. The author had talked about duplicating a railway dinner basket for the ride, as a character in Agatha Christie's The Mystery of the Blue Train had done for the journey. Having managed only one bite of his main course before the explosions had begun, Tursunov thought it was a good idea. At the grocery, he bought pasta salad, cheese, bread, smoked fish, some fruit, and bottled water. And while he would have enjoyed the old-fashioned romance of a picnic hamper, he satisfied himself with the plastic grocery bag provided by the shop. It was a short walk to the station, and it proved to be everything the author had described. There were sparrows in the rafters, and a complimentary piano in the large hall, which anyone could sit down and play. A young man of university age began playing La Marseillaise. A day or maybe even a few hours later, he might have roused some of his fellow countrymen to sing in a defiant show of patriotism. But as it stood, no one joined him. People were still in shock. With a newspaper tucked under his arm and wearing a business suit, the Tajik kept his head down as he walked to his platform. Neither the police nor the soldiers paid him much attention. They were looking for Muslim terrorists and knew one when they saw one. He didn't fit the profile. Climbing aboard the train, Tursunov found his compartment. It wasn't much bigger than a walk-in closet. He had paid extra in order to have it all to himself. The lower two bunks had been folded down and turned into beds. White pillows in plastic wrappers, sat atop thin gray duvets that resembled sleeping bags. The walls were scuffed and the floor was dirty. A bathroom was at the end of the carriage, just after the vending machines. It was a far cry from the famed Orient Express. After removing a few things, he put his suitcase on the luggage rack, sat down on one of the beds, and opened the paper. At exactly 9:22, he felt a shudder beneath him as the enormous engine at the head of the platform came to life, and the train began moving. He watched through the window as the train left the station and made its way through the city. Once the conductor had come by to check his ticket, he locked the door, unpacked his impromptu dinner basket, and assembled his meal. The fish, unfortunately, was too salty, the pasta salad too oily, and the cheese entirely too strong. Had it not been for the fruit and bread, he would have been at the mercy of the vending machine. After cleaning up his meal, he undressed, got into bed, and extinguished the light. The ride was smooth and quiet. It didn't take long for him to fall asleep. Chapter 66. Thursday. The Tajik awoke and raised his window shade as the train was passing through the coastal village of Kasis. It was just as the British author had described, cascading with red bougainvillea. After saying his prayers and doing a light round of exercises, he dressed and made a small meal of what remained of his palatable food. Then he spent the next 2 hours watching the turquoise water and pastel-colored buildings of France's decadent Riviera pass by his window. At 8:37 a.m., the train came to a stop at the Gare de Niceville. As Tursunov stepped off the train, he listened for the goodbye from the conductor. He remembered from reading the book in Lahore that it would be different here. And indeed it was. Instead of wishing departing passengers the typical Parisian bonne journée, have a good day, he wished them a beautiful belle journée. The Tajik tipped his head politely as he passed the conductor and headed out in search of coffee and breakfast. He had exactly an hour and a half until his next train, and he needed to make the most of it. As he pulled his suitcase behind him, he noticed a heavy security presence here as well. Nice was no stranger to being attacked. After what had happened in Paris, he was not surprised to see the increase in vigilance. Near the station, he found a small café. It was a warm, sunny morning, and he sat on the terrace outside, where he could have a cigarette while he waited for his food. Removing one of the burner cell phones he had purchased for the operation, he powered it up and waited for it to get a signal. Once it had, the message tone chimed. Tursunov checked his texts. There was just one. Opening it, he saw a poor camera phone photo of a strip of grass. It was code. The chemist had made it to the Nice train station. The Tajik powered off the phone. Taking a drag on his cigarette, he watched the people as they passed. The mood in the south of France was better than it had been in Paris, but not much. That was to be expected, he supposed. While the inhabitants along the Riviera despised the Parisians, they still shared a national identity as Frenchmen. As far as Tursunov was concerned, they could all go to hell. After finishing his breakfast, he took his time smoking another cigarette. That was one of the few things he liked about the French. Even if you consumed only one coffee, the price entitled you to sit at the table all day if you chose. When the allotted time had come, he paid his bill and rolled his suitcase back to the station. The chemist had not been told that they would both be on the same train. The Tajik didn't want him to know. He wanted to watch him from afar. He wanted to make sure he didn't have any surveillance following him. When he entered the station, it was even more crowded than it had been before. Seeing the lines at the ticket windows, he was glad he had purchased everything in advance in Paris. That was one of the other things he liked about the French. There was at least some semblance of organization in their rail system. Because he had purchased the tickets himself and had delivered one set to Abdul to be given to his nephew, he knew which train car the chemist would be in
and exactly where he would be sitting. Finding the platform for the train to Milan, he lingered where he knew the young man would board. 10 minutes before departure, Yunus Al-Fassi, the nephew of Abdul and son of Aziz the Lion, arrived. Tursunov watched and waited. The only person to enter the car besides Yunus was a woman with 2 children. When the conductor gave the final call, the Tajik climbed aboard. Stowing his suitcase, he made his way toward his seat. He was 2 rows back and on the other side of the aisle from Yunus. He could see the young chemist, but the young chemist couldn't see him. As the train pulled out, he made himself comfortable and settled in for the almost 5-hour ride to Milan. The trip was uneventful, though plenty of people had been stealing furtive glances at Yunus. It was the curse of being a young Arab male in the wake of an Islamic terror attack. Tursunov was confident that ISIS would have already claimed credit for what had happened in Paris. During the hour between trains in Milan, he kept a distant eye on the young chemist. Once again, he didn't detect any surveillance. He wasn't surprised. Not only did the French authorities not have the resources to follow him all the way to Nice, and then on to the border with Italy, the Italians had no actionable reason to take interest in him. Boarding the new train, they found their seats. The Tajik hadn't seen anyone that gave him any cause for concern. Nevertheless, he continued to scan for any hint of trouble. At precisely 4 o'clock, the high-speed Alta Velocità train exited the central Milan station. The trip to Rome's Termini station would take just under 3 hours. Then, provided Antonio Votari had delivered his merchandise, the final step of the operation would begin. Allah willing, it would be the biggest attack the world had ever seen. Chapter 67. Calabria. An Augusta AW-109 transported Harvath and his team from Palermo back to Sigonella Air Base. They stayed only long enough to pick up their gear, and for Harvath to stop in the hospital to wish Haney and Gage a safe trip back to the United States. As soon as that was done, they climbed back on board and took off. Argento and one of his lieutenants were with them. The rest of his men had been divided. Half had stayed at the safe house to watch over Ragusa, Naya, and the 2 bodyguards. The other half had flown on ahead to a different safe house in Calabria.
"We can make 1, maybe 2 passes of La Formicola's house, depending on our altitude," Argento said over his headset. "Anything more than that, and he's going to know something is wrong."
Harvath flashed him the thumbs up.
"If we can get it in 1, let's do it that way."
The Italian nodded and said something to his lieutenant, who was seated next to the window with a large digital SLR camera. On the opposite side, Morrison also had a camera. Lovett sat next to Harvath with a map. Barton had his eyes closed, and Stalin was reading a new book. Harvath looked at the title. "The Obstacle is the Way," by an author named Holiday. Tapping it, he asked,
"What's this one about?"
"It's about 200 pages, the Delta Force operative replied.
Harvath just shook his head.
Stalin looked up and smiled. "Stoicism," he explained. "Turning obstacles into opportunities."
"Any good?"
"I don't know. My biggest obstacle right now is that my boss keeps asking me questions and won't let me read it."
Argento translated for his lieutenant, and they both laughed. Harvath shook his head once more and turned to look out the window. The pilots raced up the Sicilian coastline, past the dramatic edifice of Mount Etna, the tallest active volcano in Europe, and crossed over the Strait of Messina to Calabria at the toe of Italy. It was little moments like these that Harvath tried to savor. He hadn't gotten much sleep and probably should have had his eyes closed like Barton, but it wasn't every day you got a ride like this. He could only imagine what it would have cost to privately hire a helicopter for this kind of tour. For the first time in a while, he thought of Lara. She would have loved it. He also thought about Reed Carlton. He would have loved it, too. In fact, the flight reminded Harvath of a story he used to tell. It was about Sicily and the CIA's precursor, the OSS, and drew a stark contrast between the two. The story centered on Max Corvo, an Italian immigrant to the United States, who joined the army in 1942. Corvo had excellent ideas on how to defeat the Axis powers in Italy, but it looked as if he was going to end up being a quartermaster and not see any action. Instead of being quiet, Corvo wrote up his plan for intelligence gathering and covert operations in Italy. The young private quickly came to the attention of the OSS, who gave him a command position in its Italian section. He was dispatched to North Africa to prepare for the invasion of Sicily. But when Corvo arrived, he found next to no resources. Undeterred, he begged, borrowed, or stole whatever he could get his hands on that would make the invasion a success. Within a month of arriving in North Africa, he had recruited his own boat squadron and had planned, trained, staffed, equipped, and executed the first covert OSS operation to the highly dangerous Gestapo-infested island of Sardinia. There, the OSS linked up with partisan and pro-Allied forces and began to lay the groundwork for an organized resistance that would be critical in the taking of Italy. What the old man loved about the story was not only the risk-taking, but the win-at-all-cost mentality. The OSS fostered creativity and bravery. To them, no mission was impossible. The organization stood behind you. It didn't get in your way. What they cared about most were results. They had one mantra, and it came straight from the founder of the OSS, Wild Bill Donovan. If you fall, fall forward. If the CIA bureaucracy were to have a mantra today, it could very well be, don't fall, or better yet, don't do anything that might result in a fall. That wasn't the old man's style, and it certainly wasn't Harvath's. For both of them, success was the only option. As a SEAL, Harvath had had it drilled into him that the only easy day was yesterday. He had been trained to expect things to get worse, and when they did, to persevere. No matter what happened, you were never out of the fight. No matter what happened, you never quit. You always found a way to successfully complete the mission. It was a philosophy that called for quick and sometimes unorthodox thinking. It required dedication and a willingness to do whatever it took. In the air-conditioned offices across Washington, it was a mindset and steadfast determination most politicians and bureaucrats couldn't understand. It was one of the biggest reasons the country was in the position it was. Fortunately, there were just enough people in D.C. who did understand. The question, though, was whether there was enough time to still pull things together. As the helicopter banked and headed north, the pilot radioed that they were 5 minutes out from Votari's. Argento told his lieutenant and Morrison to get their cameras ready. They were going to want to take as many pictures as they could during the flyby. He wasn't feeling very comfortable about the possibility of a second pass. The clouds were going to require them to fly lower than he would have liked. Harvath watched as the landscape sped by beneath the helicopter. Votari lived outside a small rural town in the foothills of the Aspromonte mountain range called Oppido Mamertina. According to Lovett, the older members of the 'Ndrangheta tried to stay under the radar. They didn't flash their massive wealth. They tried to blend in. The newer generation, mafiosi like Votari, were the opposite. They drove flashy cars, wore expensive clothes, and lived in big houses. The older members blamed the change on television and social media. Everybody wanted to be a celebrity. Everyone wanted to flaunt what he had. They swore it would be the younger generation's undoing. They warned them to tone it down, but very few listened. The one area in which the younger generation respected tradition was in where they lived. They didn't run off and move to big cities. They stayed local, often residing in the same towns or villages where they had grown up. The result was that the flashy ones stood out like sore thumbs. As they neared Votari's house, Harvath didn't need to be shown which one it was. He could spot it from the air. It was enormous.
Forest surrounded it on three sides. There was a long, straight drive that came up the front. On either side of the drive were cultivated fields with rows and rows of olive trees. There were a multitude of outbuildings. Argento's lieutenant and Morrison snapped photo after photo as they flew by. People on the property stopped what they were doing and looked up. Harvath had seen all that he needed to see. There was no reason to make a second pass. What mattered now was coming up with a plan, something Argento and his team would go along with. But that would be a lot easier said than done. Harvath had a bad feeling that the Carabinieri weren't going to like any of the ideas he was considering. Chapter 68. The helicopter dropped them off on the private aviation side of the airport at Reggio Calabria. Two unmarked SUVs were waiting for them. The ROS safe house was about 20 minutes up the coast in a town called Villa San Giovanni. It marked the closest point between mainland Italy and Sicily, and was the main embarkation point for the ferries that went back and forth to the island. With so much oceanfront, Harvath had hoped the safe house would be near the water. It wasn't. The safe house was in a residential neighborhood, several blocks up from the docks and the main train station. It was built on a hill, and its rooftop deck provided a view of the town and the ocean. The outer courtyard was walled, could fit four vehicles, and had a heavy reinforced gate to deter any would-be thieves. There were citronella candles everywhere and netting over the beds. Apparently, mosquitoes were a problem. Unloading the gear from the vehicles, Argento showed everyone to their rooms. The rest of his team was already there and had opened the doors and windows to get air moving through. Harvath dropped his gear on his bed and then walked back to the living room. Argento was uploading the pictures from both cameras onto his laptop. "Hungry?" he asked as Harvath walked in. They had eaten a late breakfast in Palermo, but nothing since. Harvath nodded, and Argento looked at his watch. "Most places won't be open for dinner until later, but I know one place we can try. It's near the water."